Well, you're listening to The Space Show on Southern FM.
Is there anybody out there?
Have you ever looked up at the night sky and wondered whether there is any life out there? You probably have. Seth Shostak and Jill Tata certainly have. They are astronomers at the SETI Institute in California. SETI is an acronym for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. While NASA's rover Curiosity trundles across the surface of Mars looking for evidence that microbes may once have lived on Mars, Shostak, Tata and their colleagues are looking further afield to see whether intelligent beings are out there. So far, their search has been unsuccessful. On this evening's space show, we're going to turn the clock back two decades to when SETI came down under to Australia and set up camp to scan the southern skies for alien radio signals.
Is there anybody out there? Is there anybody out there? Is there anybody out there?
In the mid-1990s, Project Phoenix was the world's most sensitive and comprehensive search for extraterrestrial intelligence. It was an effort to detect extraterrestrial civilizations by listening to radio signals that are either being deliberately beamed our way or are inadvertently transmitted from another planet. Phoenix was the successor to the ambitious NASA SETI program that was cancelled by a budget conscious Congress in 1993. Phoenix began observations in 1995 February using the Parkes 64-metre radio telescope in New South Wales, Australia. This is the largest radio telescope in the Southern Hemisphere. Phoenix didn't scan the whole sky. Rather, it scrutinized the vicinities of nearby sun-like stars. Such stars are most likely to host long-lived planets capable of supporting life. There were about 1,000 stars targeted for observation by Project Phoenix. All are within 200 light-years distance. Because millions of radio channels were simultaneously monitored by Phoenix, most of the listening was done by computers. Nonetheless, astronomers were required to make critical decisions about signals that looked intriguing. Well, Phoenix looked for signals between 1,000 and 3,000 megahertz. Signals that are at only one spot on the radio dial, such as narrowband signals, are the signature of an intelligent transmission. The spectrum searched by Phoenix was broken into very narrow 1 hertz wide channels, so that 2 billion channels were examined for each target star. Observations were made using the 300-meter radio telescope in Arecibo and Puerto Rico as well. By mid-1996, Phoenix had examined approximately one-third of the stars on its hit list. No clearly extraterrestrial transmissions were found, but the faint whine that would betray an alien civilization might be heard in future searches. Now, Project Phoenix was sustained entirely through private funding. Seth Shostak is an astronomer with the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. He was a member of the Project Phoenix team. During his stay in Australia, he took time out from searching for these elusive aliens to visit Mentone and to chat with me.
Welcome to the Space Show, Seth.
It's a pleasure to be here, Andrew.
What would the discovery of a fossil life on Mars do to hope of success in the SETI searches?
Well, you know, there is the claim already, of course, that there's fossilized remains of Martians to be found in this Martian meteorite, ALH84001, that was picked out of the Antarctic ice in 1984. This discovery was announced, I think, about 2 years ago, and since then, the people that have done it, mostly NASA scientists, have claimed that they've also found fossils, Martian fossils, little frozen little Martians, in a couple of other meteorites known to come from Mars. Now, if true, this would prove that there was life on Mars. And in fact, if the recent finds are true, it would probably indicate that there's still life on Mars. But whether, you know, the life is still on Mars or not, the important thing from my point of view would be that it would show that life is very common. I mean, if life springs up in a couple of planets that are right next to one another, like Mars and the Earth, then it must be life all over the place. That biology is not, you know, a miracle, not a local phenomenon. Biology is as, you know, common as a cheap hotel. It's all over the place.
Of course, there's a big step up from microbial life up to large plants, large animals, and even the bigger step up to intelligent life, isn't there?
There is, in fact, and that's really an important point. Many people are probably of the opinion that, well, okay, once you get life started, that's the difficult thing to do, and then you just sit around for 3.5 billion years, and pretty soon you have critters that are smart enough, like we are, to build radio transmitters, get on the air, and then other SETI researchers throughout the galaxy can pick them up. But that's not at all clear. I mean, more complicated life forms, I don't think that's so unexpected, although, you know, on Earth, most of the history of life on this planet is the history of bacteria and other single-celled creatures. So it took a long time to get anything more complicated going, but even that may not be so unlikely. What may be very unlikely, however, is producing intelligent life. I mean, one has to admit that. As an example, if the asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago had arrived at Earth 20 minutes earlier, we wouldn't be having this conversation because there would be dinosaurs here in Melbourne instead of humans. So, you know, maybe humans are a very unlikely evolutionary development. Intelligence may be fairly unlikely. That's a pretty contentious issue. Nobody's quite sure what the answer is, and there are people that feel very strongly one way or the other. If it's true, if there's a lot of life in the galaxy, but it's all stupid life, then obviously we're not going to hear anything on our radio transmitters unless whatever intelligent life there is has managed to spread out a little bit and, move its transmitters, as it were, offshore and to places where we might hear them.
The recent discovery of extrasolar planets must have given you a bit of a boost in confidence that you might actually have planets out there on which life could form.
Yeah, and this is also another encouraging sign for SETI, in much the way that the Martian microfossils were. I mean, we'd always assumed that planets were a dime a dozen, that they were very common, but nobody really knew that for sure. And now, of course, we know that at least a few percent of all the stars that are looked at have planets. So that means that there are at least a few billion planetary systems in our galaxy, and that's a fairly large number right there. So it is encouraging to know that ET has a home to phone, yes.
Of course, the planets that have been found so far have been gas giant planets. Are you confident that in association with them there will be smaller rocky planets, presumably the sort of planet in which life would have to be existing?
Yes, it's been somewhat dismaying that the planets that have been found are, as you say, these sort of what are called hot Jupiters, big giant planets presumably covered with methane and ammonia and other things that are more suitable for cleaning the bathroom than for living in, very close into their suns. These are toasty planets that are really not very interesting for life. But remember that the experiments that are being run are very strong filters. They find these kinds of planets that are large, planets that are close into their suns, and the small rocky planets that you've just spoken of couldn't be found with these experiments. And the question is, well, do they exist? And we don't know, but it isn't ruled out so far by these observations. So some of the planetary systems that have been found are large planets that aren't so close into their sun, so maybe they're more like our own solar system. And if you're of the optimistic bent, you might remember that some of the gas giant planets in our own solar systems have moons, such as Jupiter's moons, Europa, Callisto, and so forth, that themselves may be homes for life. So maybe just a big planet may not be the end of the story. Big planets might have small moons.
Now, you're not going to get life on planets devoid of elements like carbon and oxygen, and yet the early universe was devoid of these elements. How are the heavy elements made?
Well, heavy elements are probably everything heavier than helium is considered a heavy element to an astronomer. And the Big Bang, of course, cooked up only hydrogen and helium. Good news for dirigible makers, perhaps. But none of the sorts of things that would be useful for making up life. Those were all cooked up in stars, everything up to iron, actually. Things that are heavier than iron were made in massive stellar explosions called supernovae. But the stuff that's really requisite for life, the stuff that you need, like carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, those sorts of things, those are cooked up in stars. Then the stars die. They blow up part of themselves out into space. They sort of belch their innards into space. And then that stuff is recycled in new stars and planets. So what that means is that when the universe was very young, of course, you didn't have much of this stuff around because it hadn't been made yet. It hadn't been recycled yet. So that may mean that life couldn't get started in the very early days of our galaxy. But, you know, how early is very early days? And that's somewhat contentious, but probably you can throw out the first couple of billion years, but the galaxy's been around for maybe 10, 12 billion years. So, you know, you're not losing a lot here. I think that life could be found around most of the stars that we know of in our galaxy. Not all, the very oldest, maybe not, but I don't think that this is a serious problem. I don't think that we're going to fail to find life because it wasn't the raw material.
And would the material be spread out evenly throughout the galaxy, or do the observations show that there's some areas we're more rich in these secondary elements and others are rather devoid of them?
Well, there's certainly an abundance gradient, as it's called. There is a change of the composition of stars depending on where you are in the galaxy. I mean, the central regions of the galaxy tend to be sort of deficient in these heavy elements that you really want for life compared to the region where we are. So it may be that there are some neighborhoods that aren't as suitable for life as others, in the same way that there, you know, there's real estate here in Australia that's better for life than other parts of the continent. I don't see this as a terribly strong effect, to be honest, because it's not quite clear how impoverished a stellar neighborhood needs to be before you really can't have any life. Maybe there isn't such a thing. So in the same way that you really have life all throughout Australia, despite the fact that large sections of it are fairly dry, desert-like, maybe in the galaxy you have life throughout most of it as well. We certainly haven't skewed our observations very much when we're searching for aliens toward those parts of the galaxy which are, as it were, heavy element rich. So we haven't biased our search in any way.
We've already mentioned the disappearance of the dinosaurs and the possibility that on Mars life once existed but has now been wiped out. Do you think it's quite likely that throughout the universe life may evolve and then die out on any particular planet, perhaps die out before intelligent life can evolve?
Well, I do think that I suspect that there are many planets, undoubtedly the majority of planets, that have life don't have intelligent life, but I don't think it's because the intelligence has died out. That's just a fairly popular point of view, actually, or at least it was for the last 20 years, that, you know, you invent radio, which makes you now intelligent by our definition, because that means we can pick you up with our radio telescopes. And the moment that you become smart enough to build a transmitter, you also invent the hydrogen bomb. I mean, that all happens within 50 years of one another. And so you're on the air for a couple of hundred years, and then, bam, there's a big mushroom cloud all over the place, and that's it. You're off the air. And presumably that's happened to E.T. as well, so we're not going to hear him because he's never on the air long enough. I think that's a fairly that's a bit of a bummer. That's a bit of a downer, and I think it's unrealistic as well, because we ourselves are going to spread out fairly soon. We'll be having colonies on the moon, on Mars, maybe in big rotating cylinders in space. We'll probably colonize the asteroids in the next couple of hundred years. So that means that if we can just survive for a few hundred years without doing ourselves in, that we'll be spread out around the solar system. That means it may be very hard to get rid of our cells at that point. Now, I suspect the same thing has happened with the aliens. So I don't expect that intelligence, once it gets started, often self-destructs.
Could we advance our understanding of extraterrestrial life by doing laboratory experiments here on Earth? For example, has anyone ever made artificial life on Earth?
Well, I think that some of my colleagues feel that I am one of those experiments, actually. No, I don't think that we... I mean, obviously, we haven't made artificial life here on Earth yet. It's almost a scary thought to think that we may do so within the next decade or two. There are people who think that that's likely. That's a whole other subject, of course. But it's true that we don't know very well how life got started on Earth. In fact, we don't know how it got started on Earth. And that inhibits our ability to say whether life would get started on other planets. But, you know, you can short-circuit all that. Even though you don't understand how it got started on Earth, if you find life, you know, compelling evidence for life on Mars or under the icy crust of Jupiter's moon Europa or some other place nearby, then even though you don't know how it got started, you can say with some confidence that it's going to happen often.
Now, you've published a book recently. What's it called?
The book is called Sharing the Universe, Perspectives on Extraterrestrial Life.
And it covers this sort of topic, doesn't it?
It does, actually. It talks about where life might have cooked up, what the probability is that it's done so, how we might find it, and what that would mean to our day-to-day life if we were to hear the aliens.
And this is an approachable and readable book?
It is. This book is intended for the general public, so it's not a technical book. It's intended to be interesting for just about anybody.
And how can people get hold of it?
Well, it's fairly easy to find the book. You just go down to your local book publisher. It's published here in Australia by Lansdowne Publishing, but it's called Sharing the Universe, and just ask your local bookseller to get the book for you if they don't have it in stock.
Well, thank you for joining us tonight on The Space Show, Steve.
I've really enjoyed being here, Andrew.
Thank you.
And I was chatting with Steve Shostak, an astronomer at the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. He was a staff member on Project Phoenix, and we were talking in the courtyard of a Mentone Motel, which explains some of the traffic noise you may have heard there. Now, once again, that book is called Sharing the Universe, Perspectives on Extraterrestrial Life. It has a foreword by Frank Drake, and it answers the questions, where are the extraterrestrials likely to be hanging out? What will they look like and be like? And what is their interest in us, and how can we find them? So this is a witty and informative book. And Publishers Weekly said of it, the book is rich in considered engaging science. Sections on possible alien behavior, on motives for contact and means of contact are compelling as they reveal as much about us as about anyone who may pop across for a visit. We have more on the search for extraterrestrial intelligence coming up.
This is Southern FM 88.3.
Is there anybody out there? Is there anybody out there? Is there anybody out there?
During Project Phoenix's time at the Parkes Radio Telescope, team leader Jill Tarter popped down to Melbourne. I caught up with her at the World Congress Centre.
Good evening, Jill. Welcome to the Space Show.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What is SETI?
SETI is an attempt to detect evidence of extraterrestrial technologies by listening, in our case, for radio signals that may be transmitted by a distant technology.
And it was originally funded by NASA, wasn't it? That sort of a large project to look for these signals from outer space. But they cancelled it. Why?
Well, it wasn't canceled by NASA. It was canceled by the United States Congress, who gives NASA their funding. And it was in particular canceled by one senator from Nevada who didn't think the program had a very high priority. And unfortunately, not too many people in the Congress actually knew about us, and it was very easy to laugh at this search for little green men, ha, ha, ha. And it was terminated by the Congress.
So where did you go from there? I mean, you just didn't throw up your arms in horror and say, oh, all's lost, what happened?
Well, we had a little rough time, and we reorganized ourselves and shook off the dust. And we went to private individuals of great wealth and with great vision. And we've been successful in raising enough funds to keep going. Our goal right now is to try and establish a large endowment on the order of $100 million U.S. in order to keep this sort of research going far into the future, as long as may be necessary.
And you came to Australia as part of this project. Why did you come to Australia?
Well, our first observing, actually, as Project Phoenix, after we arose from the ashes of congressional termination, the first observing was done in Australia, and that's because we have targets scattered all over the sky, and you see the southern half, ideally. So we came here and used two telescopes, one at Parkes in New South Wales, the other north in Coonabarabran. We used the two telescopes cooperatively together to try and eliminate many signals that are due to our own technology.
Things like cars driving past.
Well, more like satellites or airplanes going overhead or mobile cellular telephones or microwave ovens, that kind of thing.
And what happened? Did you get any signals?
Well, we did get a number of signals. Not an overwhelming number. The use of the two telescopes, which was the first time we had ever done that, proved very, very efficient in filtering out our own interference. And in the end, out of more than 25,000 different observations of different stars at different frequencies, we only had 39 signals that caused us to stop the observing, move the telescopes off source, and go track down the signal. These were 39 potentially interesting candidates, and we got excited about each of them. But in the end, they all turned out to be our own terrestrial technology.
So you weren't able to say, hey, folks, we found it.
No, we couldn't say we found it. That's the bad news. On the other hand, the good news is that there were no mysteries, nothing left unexplained. This idea of using two telescopes works very well and allows us in real time, when we think we have something, to go chasing after it.
And that's the important thing, isn't it, real time, that you can actually lock onto a signal straight away without having to say a couple of weeks later when you're analyzing the data, hey, there was something there, let's go back, look for it, and it's gone.
That's right. We need to be able to confirm and verify the signal and, if at all possible, get somewhere else in the world to give us an independent verification that they can see it too.
So having drawn a blank here in Australia, you packed away your crates, put them back on a ship, and where did you go?
Well, after we left Australia, we spent about 2 years at telescopes in West Virginia and Georgia in the United States, on the east coast of our country. 140-foot telescope at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory and a 30-meter telescope at Woodbury, Georgia, that the students and faculty at Georgia Tech helped us to rebuild from an AT&T ground station. So, again, when we were in Australia, we looked at a couple of hundred stars. We did the same sort of thing, northern stars from West Virginia and Georgia. And right now, we've just moved the equipment to the largest telescope in the world, to Arecibo in Puerto Rico. And prior to the hurricane that came through last week, we were observing at Puerto Rico with a second telescope at Jodrell Bank in England, again doing this interferometer. And the observations were going well until the wind picked up and we were off the telescope, and we won't be back there again until March. But every 6 months now for the next few years, we'll have an observing campaign between these two telescopes.
And no signals yet?
Well, not yet. If we had found something, you'd certainly hear about it, because that's our intention, to tell the world.
What's the recent discovery of more planets going around other stellar systems? Obviously, we can't see these stars. But is this giving you hope that the search might eventually be successful?
Well, for years, our theorists have been telling us that when stars like the Sun form, planets will be the rule rather than the exception. And to a degree, we begin to prove that and verify that. The planets that we found so far are not exactly what we expected. We didn't expect to find large super-Jupiter planets in tucked up close to their stars. So there's more variety in the way that solar systems formed than we might have believed in the first place. But planetary systems do form, and that does make it more probable that there will be habitats for other creatures.
What directions do you see the search for extraterrestrial intelligence taking in the near future?
Well, in the radio search, we will try and use or build larger and larger collecting area so that we can listen for fainter signals, and we'll need to increase our target list from 1,000 to 100,000 or 1,000,000 perhaps before we succeed. Other directions that are being enabled by new technologies will be searches for very rapid optical pulses, something that lasts only a microsecond or a nanosecond. Now, at optical frequencies, an extraterrestrial transmitter will have to outshine its star to be detectable by us, because we can't separate the planet from the star. But they don't have to outshine their star all the time. If they do it for a very brief moment, and we have good enough photon detectors with fast enough time registration that we can capture that burst of optical photons over a very short period of time, then it is a detectable signal. So that's something that we'll be looking at in the future. We'll also be considering the ramifications of small, tiny nanoprobes, things that might have been sent by a distant technology and that might currently be in our solar system. We haven't come up with any effective ways to make searches systematically for such things, but we're beginning to think about it more seriously.
Like most people, I've seen the film Contact. Most of our listeners will have seen it as well. What did you think of the film?
I thought Contact was brilliant. I really enjoyed it. It was the first time I've seen a film where scientists are treated really as human beings, with all of our warts and idiosyncrasies and our passions and obsessions, but we're not kind of queer, white, lab-coated people out to destroy or save the world or something. I mean, we're just individuals working very hard on something that we believe is worthwhile.
The character that Jodie Foster played was said to be loosely based on yourself. How do you feel about that?
Well, certainly Jodie Foster played the role of a woman who does what I do, and she did it very, very well.
How did your interest in SETI start?
I got started working on SETI when I was a graduate student at UC Berkeley, and a professor, an X-ray astronomer, Stuart Boyer, had a very clever idea for using the university's radio telescope at Hat Creek in a way that allowed him to piggyback on traditional radio astronomical observations and do SETI at the same time. And I simply knew how to program an old ancient computer he was given as a bit of cast-off equipment. And I was the only one around who still remembered how to program it. So he came to me, and I got interested in the idea.
You mentioned that the Congress canceled the program, the original NASA-funded search, because of ignorance. Have you arranged a special congressional showing of the film Contact for them?
That actually is a great idea. I think that it's still politically incorrect to try and put SETI back into NASA, but the time will come.
Yeah. Do you have a timeline you're working towards?
No, it's politics, and politics will determine its own timeline. We'll just try and be ready.
So it's just kind of out of your hands, as it were.
That's right.
That's right. I'd rather work with telescopes than politicians any day.
Okay, Jill. Well, thank you very much for joining us tonight on the Space Show.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
I was in a conversation with Jill Tarter, who was the director of Project Phoenix at the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. And we spoke there in the mid-late 1990s at the World Congress Center.
Online all the time at southernfm.com.au.
Is there anybody out there? Is there anybody out there? Is there anybody out there?
During my chat with Jill, we referred to the role of Jodie Foster in the movie Contact. Now, the parallels between the movie character Ali Arroway and Jill Tarter should not be overstated, but they are there. For example, the child Ali Arroway stands under a night sky and wonders whether there's any life out there.
Hey, Dad.
Yeah?
Do you think there's people on other planets?
I don't know, Sparks. But I guess I'd say, if it is just us, it seems like an awful waste of space.
Ali tries to call her dead parents on a ham radio.
CQ. CQ. CQ, this is W9GFO. Repeat, this is W9GFO, come back. CQ, this is W9GFO, come back. I'm going to need a bigger antenna.
Later in the film, we are introduced to some of adult Ali Arroway's radio astronomy colleagues and to the idea that the search for extraterrestrial intelligence is considered way out, as something to be embarrassed about.
Ali.
Ken Clark.
Hey.
They said you've been up at Owens Valley working under Drumlin. How'd you like them? That much, and about what I'd expect after what he had to say about you.
Well, what was that?
That you are brilliant, driven, a major pain in the ass, and obsessed with a field of study that he considers tantamount to professional suicide.
Yo. Anything else?
Nope. Those were the highlights. Davio, Dr. Vernon, Dr. Arroway.
Hey, hi there.
How you doing?
Good.
And I believe you've already met our tireless research assistant, Mr. Fisher.
Yep.
Here.
Well, this is Cologne. Rick's looking at the black hole at the center of M87. Eli's studying Markarian 541, a major gamma ray source. And Dr. Arroway here will be spending her precious telescope time listening for
little green men.
Adult Ali Arroway explains her search and motivation to religious scholar Palmer Joss.
All right, you see that sort of large W-shaped constellation right there? That's Cassiopeia. And Cassiopeia A gives off a whole lot of radio signals. I actually listen to that a lot. It's a remnant of a supernova.
When did you know you wanted to be an astronomer?
Well, when I was about 8 years old, I was watching the sunset, and I asked my dad, what's that bright star over there? And he said, He said that it wasn't really a star at all. That was actually...
That's not a star, that's a planet.
A whole planet called Venus.
That's a planet Venus.
Which should be over there soon. He said, you know why they called it Venus? Because they thought it was so beautiful and glowing. But what they didn't know is that it's filled with deadly gases and sulfuric acid rain. I thought, this is it. I'm hooked.
400 billion stars out there, just in our galaxy alone. If only one out of a million of those had planets, all right, and if just one out of a million of those had life, and if just one out of a million of those had intelligent life, there would be literally millions of civilizations out there.
Well, if there wasn't, it'd be an awful waste of space.
Amen.
And just like Jill Tata, Ellie learns that the government has cancelled the funding for her search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
Ellie?
Hey, Kent, what are you doing up so early, huh?
I was thinking, we'd make a pretty good team.
What?
We could put together a kick-ass ad hoc SETI program.
Hey, what are you talking about?
You know the very large array in New Mexico? It would be a dynamite place to do some serious SETI.
What are you talking about, Kent?
SETI work. Drumlin pulled the plug. We're homeless.
Is it true? Now that you pulled the plug?
I know you can't see it now, but I'm doing you a favor.
Oh,
you're far
great.
Too promising
that's
a scientist great. To be wasting your gifts on this nonsense.
Look, I don't consider what could potentially be the most important discovery of the human race nonsense, okay? There's 400 billion stars out there.
And only two probabilities. One, there is intelligent life out there, but it's so far away you'll never contact it in your lifetime.
Like
and
you're making a decision.
Two, there's nothing out there but noble gases and carbon compounds, and you're wasting your time. In the meantime, you won't be published, you won't be taken seriously, and your career will be over before it's begun.
So what? It's my life!
And just like Jill Tata, Ellie seeks funding from companies and foundations, but always gets refused. Refused until one fateful day, she stands in front of three funding judges in a corporate boardroom.
This is a unique time in our history, in the history of any civilization. It's the moment of the acquisition of technology. That's the moment where contact becomes possible. The Very Large Array in New Mexico is the key to our chances for success. With its 27 linked radio telescopes, we can search more accurately than at any other conventional facility. Now, we've already gotten the preliminary approval to buy the telescope time from the government. Now, all we really need is the money.
A nice presentation, Doctor. But while our foundation arm does have a mandate to support experimental programs, we must confess that your proposal seems less like science and more like science fiction.
Science fiction. Ah, you're right. It's crazy. In fact, it's even worse than that. Nuts. Want to hear something really nutty? I heard of a couple guys that want to build something called an airplane. You know, you get people to go in it and then fly around like birds. It's ridiculous, right? Or what about breaking the sound barrier? Or rockets to the moon? Or atomic energy? Or a mission to Mars? Science fiction, right? Look, all I'm asking is for you to just have the tiniest bit of vision. You know, to step back for 1 minute and look at the big picture. To take a chance on something that just might end up being the most profoundly impactful moment for humanity, for the history of history.
Ellie is told that her lease on the very large array of radio telescopes in New Mexico is about to be terminated.
What is this? Is this a personal vendetta now?
It's not just Drumlin. There's been enormous pressure from other scientists as well.
It doesn't matter anyway, because Haddon's funding us for another 2 years.
These are government-owned telescopes. They can lease them to whomever they want, and they don't want the High Priestess of the Desert using them anymore.
What?
Staring at static on TV for hours at a time, listening to washing machines? Did you really think these stories wouldn't get
around? I was looking for patterns in the chaos. Come on.
It doesn't matter anymore. We're a joke to them. They want us out. We've got 3 months until the paperwork goes through.
Fine. Just start looking for other funding. I'll just start writing.
Could you face reality, please? Just this once, Ellie. We lost. It's over.
Fine. I'm not stopping.
I have to go it alone, I'll go it alone. I've done it before.
With time remaining on the radio telescope dwindling, Ellie finally hears the signal she has spent her life searching for. The film accurately captures the desperate excitement of the receipt of the first signal from an extraterrestrial civilization.
Polarized set of moving pulses, amplitude modulated.
Unlocked. Systems check out signal across the board. What's the frequency?
4.4623 gigahertz. Hydrogen times pi. Told you.
Strong sucker, too.
I got it. I'm patched in.
All right, let me hear it.
The excitement of finding a signal from an extraterrestrial civilization, something that hasn't happened in reality just yet. Well, during the filming of Contact, former Young Australian of the Year Brian Gainsler was using the Very Large Array in New Mexico for his astronomical research. In a lecture at Museum Victoria, Brian was describing how the Very Large Array can give detailed information about the shell of gas expanding out from supernova 1987A. That's an exploded star. As you will hear, he digressed from his talk to describe his experience in meeting Jodie Foster.
So, are we stuck? Is this the end? Are we not going to be able to work out what's going on? Well, the answer is no, we're not stuck. There is a way out. And the way out is to be a bit sneaky. Instead of building one big telescope, just to build lots and lots of little telescopes and join them all up with computers. So if you've got one telescope here, and one here, and one here, and one here, you can connect them all up with cable and computers and simulate one big telescope. And that way, you can get out of it. So what you do is you build lots of little telescopes, and that makes a type of telescope called an array. So this is probably the most famous one of these arrays in the world. This is at a place called New Mexico. It's in New Mexico in the USA. And each one of these dishes is quite small. They're only 25 metres across. There's actually 27 of them. And when you connect them all up, they make one big telescope 30 kilometres across. Absolutely huge. By the way, this telescope is called the VLA, which of course stands for the Very Large Array. Astronomers don't think very hard when they think of names. And if any of you have seen the movie Contact, anyone seen that movie? Yeah, okay, well, this was the telescope that Jodie Foster actually used in that movie. In fact, she wasn't the one using it. I was actually the one using it that week. I was actually using the telescope when Jodie Foster came along to use the telescope, and it was very irritating because I was looking at my star, and the director would say, oh, look, can we just move the telescope a bit to the side, thanks? And I was saying sort of, I don't think so. But in any case, that was pretty exciting. I got to chat to Jodie Foster and explain to her everything. But she and I were using this telescope together when Contact was being filmed, 30 kilometres across.
And that was Brian Gainsler, Australian astronomer. And you've been listening to a space show special on the search for extraterrestrial intelligent life.
Is there anybody out there? Is there anybody out there? Is there anybody out there?
It's like blind.
Okay. I expect to be able to hand over to you.
What's that?
I expect to be able to hand over to you on time.
Yeah, okay.
Is there anybody out there?